Rich Klein is the managing partner, McLarty Media, and managing director, Middle East and North Africa. Rich was part of the 1992 Clinton-Gore presidential campaign, helping to craft policy and messaging on emerging global issues. He was subsequently appointed by President Clinton to head the speechwriting staff and be part of the Policy and Planning Office of the Department of Commerce, reporting directly to Secretaries Ron Brown, Mickey Cantor, and Bill Daley. From the Commerce Department, Rich was appointed by President Clinton to serve as Special Assistant to International Affairs at the Department of State, the bureau charged with monitoring and enforcing international economic sanctions. During our chat, we talked about Rich's purview of geopolitics as a former member of the State Department, the hot wars in Russia and Israel-Palestine, past administration's foreign policy, both good and bad, why NATO matters more than ever, and the continuing dysfunction of our current Congress. It was my honor to have Rich join me on the program. I truly enjoyed every minute of the storied history, tenure, and storytelling of all things Washington, D.C. Thank you, Rich Klein, for joining me on Reporter this morning. I really appreciate it.
Well, it's morning where you are.
That's right. It's 10 o'clock in Cairo.
I got 9 hours on you.
That is true. And by the way, I really appreciate you taking this talk in Cairo at 10 o'clock at night. So, you know, friendship has its benefits.
Happy to do it. It's good to see you.
Good to see you. So on my last show, I interviewed your friend, Tom Shanker, former Pentagon war correspondent for the New York Times, former bureau chief in Moscow for the Chicago Tribune. So thanks again for that introduction, because it was an awesome chat. And as we talked about off camera, Tom Shanker is a true mensch. And I had a great time getting to know him, and we're still communicating today about working together on some other stories. So
I'm glad to hear it. You know, they don't make them like Tom.
They really don't. He is. And as you know, Tom recently co-wrote a book with Andrew Hone called Age of Danger, Keeping America Safe in the Era of New Superpowers, New Weapons, and New Threats. And during our chat, we talked at length about the military's warning and action systems and how America has failed to keep up with our military readiness since 9/11, specifically something that Tom and Andrew called the Zoom effect, which was after 9/11, we kind of zoomed our resources onto terrorism, global terrorism, as opposed to historical wars and some of that piece, which we're not going to get into today too much because that was already covered. But Tom and his co-author, Andrew, predicted a lot of what's going on today, specifically in Russia, as well as the conflict in Israel and China. And this book was fascinating, slightly terrifying. And because of that, I really wanted to start reporting on many more stories based on our geopolitical position in the world. And of course, you know, your name popped up in my head again. It was like, I need to get Rich back on the show, talk specifically about what's going on based on your history, working in the State Department for President Clinton. So let me just ask you this, sir. You know as well as I do, especially being over in Cairo and per our off-camera chat, you know, you've been talking with a lot of your friends from Spain and Ireland and different parts of Europe that are concerned about what's going on here with our American politics. So why don't we start there? What's going on with our Congress, specifically the funding?
I'm here with a large multinational group of folks, most of whom are from Europe, and the conversations have tended towards the what is going on with America, where are you going? Where are you leading us? Yeah. And isn't that kind of the core question? I mean, the rest of the world does look to us, not just for the sake of history, but we tend to forget here at home that America stands for something to the rest of the world. There are certain ideals and values that the rest of the world believes are fundamental American values and kind of a true north. To the rest of the world, you can come to America and you can pray as you want, say what you want, be who you want. And as long as you pay your taxes and abide by the law, there's no limit to where you can take your life. And many of these people come from places where those opportunities don't exist, or where the rules are not so free and open. And so they look to us as an ideal. And there's been a trend over the last five, 6 years where they wonder, what are we about? And if we're not the standard bearer for these values, why should they expect their own governments to embrace them and advance them? And it is a reminder of values do matter. When I worked for President Clinton and when the president left the White House, one of the things that he was really, really strong at explaining was problems don't end where borders exist. And the president used to like to talk about the fact that, you know, why should we care about AIDS in Haiti? Because mm-hmm. Haitian refugees wind up coming ashore in Florida. Why should we care about Chinese economic or energy policy? Because the coal that China burns to generate its electricity becomes our acid rain. Now, granted, you know, this is a time when we only had to worry about acid rain. But the last 4 years have shown it to us again with COVID. I mean, you cannot pull up the drawbridge and realistically think that you have isolated yourselves from all of the world's challenges and risks and problems. And so instead of trying to pretend they're not there, why not lead on them and try to direct world events in a way that solve them and in the process enhance American security and stability?
Agreed. And I think that, so you mentioned the last 4 or 5 years, and this is something that I think has been a big shift. And maybe it's part of what's going on with Congress, or maybe it's just politics in general. But if you look at, you know, historical isolationism, specifically even back, you know, in the FDR administration, Henry Wallace famously talked about being isolationist and was, you know, coined in history as being someone that he actually said that if America wants to contain communism expansion, the only way to do so is to give the common man something better than communism. And so there was a lot of talk back then that, hey, what if Wallace won the election instead of Truman? Right. What would have taken place at that point? And, you know, would we be in a different place today, specific to isolationism? And, you know, what would our position have been in World War II? I mean, there's just so many things that would have changed, right? This isn't new.
Yeah, but I do think a lot of what we're living through now is pure political calculation.
Pure political. Got it.
In that you cannot tell me that Lindsey Graham really, truly thinks that the U.S. should distance itself from the NATO alliance and not play an important role in security in Europe. You cannot tell me that Marco Rubio does not believe that American leadership is essential in our own hemisphere and that we need to engage with our neighbors. We need to have dialogue. We need to help them improve their rules of law, their standards of living. I do not believe that these guys suddenly really believe that we need to go it alone and the rest of the world can go to hell. But we live in a political environment where for the Republican Party, if Barack Obama was for it or if Joe Biden supports it, we oppose it reflexively. And, you know, some of the examples on that, go back and look at the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the TPP trade agreement, which was very close to being finalized, and then President Trump immediately withdrew and tore up. Now, I'm not saying that it was a perfect trade agreement, but it achieved something that was really important, which was it knitted together economies in Asia with our economy at the exclusion of China. So even if it's not a perfect trade agreement, even if it's a good trade agreement or a trade agreement that's okay and you know, in the coming years needs to be improved, that accomplishment of creating this economic center of gravity and knitting us together more closely with some dynamic economies that are driven by technology and trade, and that China, in fact, will be in a weaker position, that is in the U.S. interest. At the moment the TPP got torn up, what did China do? They announced their own, you know, Belt and Road expansion, and they have essentially tied Asian economies more closely to them than to us. That is not in America's best interests. It is not good for our economy. It is not good for our security. It is not good for our supply chains. It is not good for our businesses. I could make the same argument about the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Agreement, you know, the JCPOA agreement with Iran. It was not a perfect agreement, but it was a good agreement that slowed Iran's march towards nuclear weapons down. They made part of their research infrastructure more accessible, that made it harder for them to conceal what they were doing. And by exiting that, they have now been unrestrained. And instead of being over a year away from having enough fissile material to create a weapon, they're weeks away when and if they ever make the choice to do so. How are our interests advanced by doing that? You know, there were a number of people who I would talk to in the Gulf region who really were not fans of the U.S.-Iran nuclear agreement. And they were critical of the Obama White House. They said that, that you know, the Iranians know that President Obama is hungry for this agreement and is not going to get up and leave the table. And therefore, the Iranians have some leverage in the negotiations, and they will the final agreement will probably tilt somewhat in Iran's favor. And I don't doubt that. I don't question that. But does it matter? The outcome was stability, predictability, and a safer security environment in a very volatile region. And we don't have that now. And so the idea that simply because the other party is for it, I'm going to reflexively oppose it, it's leading us to choices that are not in the nation's best interests. And they haven't been replaced on the Republican side, they haven't been replaced with anything that would get us to the same moment of enhanced security.
Yeah, that's a great point, because the one thing that specifically geopolitics, I follow a couple journalists, and I talked to you about this previously, but you know, Brett Stevens is a foreign correspondent for me of the Wall Street Journal, and someone that I follow and respect. He's a conservative thinker and writer, and he wrote a book, American Retreat, in 2014, I think. And I revisited that book recently, specific to our geopolitics. And most of the book is laced with language around things like progressive ideology, specific to isolationism. Right. So if you look back 15, 20 years ago, it was the liberals that were talking about this. Right. And today, to your point, it's not just the liberals, it's the GOP. And your mention of Lindsey Graham is really, I think, astute, because as someone who really understands geopolitics, considering his best friend was John McCain,
right,
and they had this wonderful relationship, and he had mad respect for John's ability to love the United States of America and serve the United States of America and understand the bravery and everything that involved specific to Mr. McCain. And I think that that's where I'm really perplexed as a layperson. Like, what?
Yeah, you and I cannot distill any logic out of it, because the party of Reagan that continues to, you know, beatify the president and you know, Ronald Reagan is, you know, is essentially the, you know, the patron saint of the Republican Party. He would when it comes to national security and international affairs, he would recognize it. You know, he was a true Cold Warrior. The idea that the U.S. would roll over on an ally in Europe, would be beyond recognition to him.
Yeah.
You know, that we would not simply say our word is rock solid with our NATO allies and there's nothing that can get in the way of that. Instead, to have a candidate for the White House saying, well, we'll just tell Russia to do whatever the hell they want. You know, you go back and you remember Reagan's jokes about, you know, I've signed legislation to outlaw the Soviet Union. We begin bombing in 5 minutes. There was loyalty, there were common values. These were allies who were with us, and we were with them through World War II. I mean, Ronald Reagan's, you know, I think you could argue it, but I think his closest international relationships was with Margaret Thatcher.
Mm-hmm.
And now to have his party appear to tell our European allies you're on your own, and refuse to stand up to Vladimir Putin, simply why? Because it's what Joe Biden wants to do.
Yeah.
I cannot explain this to you. Sure, you want to tell me that you would like to see some more transparency and some more accountability on where American aid to Ukraine goes. I can live with that. I get that. But the idea that you're going to let them come to the brink of collapse and not agree to send them support, and you want to be calculating about it, you know, 90% of the aid that is directed for Ukraine is spent in the U.S., keeping American weapons manufacturers busy and adding to their production. I can remember in the early 90s, there was a movement. I think the Pentagon had wanted out of, I may not have the details exactly right. I think they wanted out of the F-14 program. The aircraft to the Pentagon was obsolete. They wanted to stop manufacturing it. And it was heavily made in Missouri and in Texas. Those congressional delegations basically said, you know what? Here are how many tens of thousands of jobs that are connected to that, not just manufacturing those aircraft, but all of the suppliers, all of the components, everything that goes into this. And if the Pentagon doesn't want or need this aircraft, that does not mean that there are not foreign military sales to be had to our allies who can still utilize it. Yeah. And it is good for our economy, and it is good for our relationships internationally, and we need to keep these aircraft manufactured. Well, it's the same thing now with Ukraine. I mean, you know, the shells that we're making are manufactured all over the country. The weapons that they need desperately are manufactured here. And that money is spent here. And those paychecks are here. And those and the more work means more hiring here. And yet we don't hear that. I'm kind of very surprised that organized labor and workers in these factories haven't made it known that they really need this aid to go to Ukraine, because it is right for our values, because it's right for our national security interests, and because it is right for our economy.
No, that's exactly it. And I have a letter that I referenced here. Paul Jagoda is the editor of the editorial pages of the Wall Street Journal, and he penned it a piece last November talking specifically about the decline of America's defenses. And he wrote, "The weakness has been exposed in sharp relief to the last 2 years, and it's worse than most Americans know. We face an array of adversaries more formidable than at any time since World War II, and we aren't prepared for the moment. On a visit to the White House, I met with senior foreign policy officials, and the conversation included his concern about Iran propping up Venezuela's dipper ship and oil supplies. And he said, 'Have you considered intercepting the tankers?' And he said, 'Well, the nearest ship we have is a Dutch frigate in the middle of the Atlantic. This isn't Ronald Reagan's Navy," right? So to your point around Reagan, and what he was doing specific to geopolitics and budgets and keeping our allies going, there's a big difference. And I looked it up after I read the article. The ship count that we had for the U.S. Navy in 1964, we patrolled the seas with 859 ships. In 1984, during Reagan's actual Navy, we had 557. And in 2014, it was 289. And today, in 2023, it's 291. So if you just look at that, we had two ships in the last 10 years. And so a lot of what's going on specific to our conversations in the body politic is that if you look at folks like Reagan, and I'm glad you brought him up, because most of my conservative friends reference Reagan all the time. As you mentioned, he's kind of like the go-to ombudsman for everything old school Republican. And today, when you look at what's taking place with our GOP, Lindsey Graham and his ilk, is that we're now saying that we don't have the budget. I mean, obviously, our House Speaker, I don't think really understands history. I don't know exactly what...
I agree with you.
The malfunction is there. But to your point, if we are delaying on these wars specific to Ukraine and Israel, we are hurting ourselves budgetary. We are hurting our own supplies. We are hurting our reputation with our allies throughout the globe. And I think bigger, I'd like to hear your take on this too, is there any theory, or excuse me, is there any credence to the broken windows philosophy of international policy? And just for my listeners who don't understand the broken windows policy, is there's there was a study in the 70s specific to this, and it was coined by George Kelling, who was a criminologist at Rutgers, and James Wilson, who was a political scientist at Harvard. And they penned an essay in the Atlantic Monthly in 1982, I think, and it was their attempt to understand the nature of communal order. And in it, they took a car. Zimbardo actually took a parked car, opened the hood, and put it in the Bronx. No license plates on it. And he left it there for 10 minutes. And it was completely ransacked.
Right.
Just gone. Right. They took the batteries. They took the tires. They took everything. 10 minutes. He took the same car, opened the hood, took the plates off, and put it in a Tony neighborhood here in the Silicon Valley in Palo Alto, right next to the Stanford campus. And he left it there for 7 days. Nothing happened to it, right? Then he took a sledgehammer and he went and bashed the front window in and left it within minutes after they broke it, right? The vandals came in and did the same thing. They raided it like piranhas. And the neat thing about this study was that it was, and he was clear to say this, is that it was white progressive people that went after. So it was like a herd mentality. And right. I mentioned the broken windows theory because when I was reporting on Defund the Police, it was a theory that I studied quite often to understand, hey, you know, what took place with this? Does it work? You know, New York City, as the largest police department in the country, it did adopt this theory. And based on the fact that if you don't replace that broken window, all the other windows will be broken pretty quickly. And if there's vandalism and graffiti and just the idea specific to the aura of the area, wherever that may be, is that there's no order.
It's the psychology of believing that there is order, not chaos, that there is safety, you know, and not risk and threat. And whether you kind of take ownership and feel a sense of ownership for your community or not.
Exactly. Exactly. And do you think that is applicable to international global politics?
Well, I do. I mean, aren't we seeing it now? Right.
And I think
you've got Iranian proxies who have largely been unchallenged for the last 5 to 10 years.
Yeah.
Who have armed themselves and expanded their capacity, to wreak havoc. And the idea that the Houthi militia in Yemen can somehow jeopardize global trade because they've got Iranian supplied missiles and rockets and they can deploy them effectively and all they have to do is park their launchers under bridges and inside buildings when we are flying sorties to try to take them out, and then they drive them back out and shoot them again. I mean, that math doesn't really make sense. What we just saw in Gaza, you know, Hamas, they have moved from, you know, a couple of rockets that they don't know where they're going to land to fairly sophisticated weapons manufacturing because of the smuggling that they were able to pull off, because of the tunnels they were able to dig. And how did they do that? Well, they were able to divert humanitarian aid. They were able to bring Iranian advisors into Gaza through boat drops offshore. But now, you know, these little groups are not so little anymore. And the threat that they pose to world order is fairly significant. And if you want to break it down to crass elements, you know, our economy depends on an awful lot of trade with Europe. We depend on an awful lot of things that are shipped in the Suez Canal. We depend on an awful lot of energy that comes from that part of the world. If you say, I don't care about values and I don't, you know, everybody's on their own for their own security and stability, well, we still have jobs that depend on other markets. And mm-hmm. we still have manufacturing that depends on supply chains from other places. And even if you just want to boil it down to dollars and cents, it is still important to have stability and order and for the U.S. military to be able to enforce that when others like Hamas or Hezbollah try to disrupt it.
See, now I agree with you. And that was the funny thing that I mentioned to you. When I brought you when we talked before the camera started, I was like, I didn't even ask your opinion of this, Rich. I just assumed that you would actually think that isolationism is a bad idea based on your tenure in the Clinton administration.
I'm decidedly old school. Yeah. You know, the conventional wisdom on Capitol Hill for 100 years was that politics ends at the water's edge. And my first boss, Dave Gergen, who worked for Presidents Nixon and Ford and Reagan and Clinton, used to say that America is strongest and most stable at home when we are admired and respected internationally. Mm-hmm. Those are not controversial things to say and believe. And I think that they are fundamentally true. And yet now that seems to be out of date. That seems to be old school. And I don't quite understand why and how.
I don't either. And I think that it's one of those things where if you look at a lot of, let's just say, Republican journalists or conservative journalists, there's been a new thing is that for years, as I've been following this, if you look at a lot of reporters talk about how we've lost our edge after Ronald Reagan, or maybe even after George W. Herbert Walker Bush. So, you know, they say that we started to become a little too lackadaisical in our global foreign policy, even starting with Clinton. And that's why I wanted to talk to you about that. And they reference Somalia all the time and the withdrawal of the troops, and we didn't do anything there. And so we started to send messages, you know, to despots like Putin and, you know, Xi and obviously the Ayatollah and folks like that. I mean, do you think that Clinton was weak on foreign policy? Do you think I don't know, because that's a big postulated theory.
I think that that we did not understand and fully digest what the end of the Cold War really meant.
Okay,
you know, we can focus on that era as a time of high tension, high risk. You can point to the moments where wider war was right at the edge. But I could also, you know, a lot of people will tell you, yes, but there was a structure to it. The Cold War, and as tense as it was, there were ways to release the built-up pressure. We and the Soviets understood that before anybody made a move that could not be recalled, we had to have some ability to communicate and back channel and warn each other.
Yeah.
And with the end of the Cold War, with the collapse of the Soviet Union, we believed, you know, liberal democracy had won. It was our world, game over. And what we've learned now is that it wasn't game over. It was halftime. Maybe end of the third quarter, but it was not game over.
Yeah.
But I do think for President Clinton, you know, in having inherited from George H.W. Bush a world where the biggest threat to our security was greatly diminished, and we were essentially writing the new rules for the global marketplace. And so you did have, you know, free trade was really important. And President Clinton, he loved to quote, I think we attribute it to Averell Harriman, but I believe the quote has lots of fathers. But it was, when goods move, armies don't. And the idea being that through free trade and through prosperity, we would halt or slow wars around the world and conflicts around the world. You know, the idea was, if people have jobs and paychecks and a belief that their children's futures are better, they're not so eager to pick up guns and go to war. And maybe that was naive. You know, we certainly learned that in the Balkans, that some parts of the world hold on to grudges for 1,000 years. We saw it in Iraq, where after Saddam was removed, we basically loosed tribal conflict and grudges that had been there for generations. Mm-hmm. But by and large, I think that there's a great scene at the end of Charlie Wilson's War, where Gustav Rakotis, the CIA officer who had led the effort in Afghanistan, tells Charlie Wilson the story about the boy in the village who is given a horse and everybody thinks it's wonderful. And one of the elders says, we'll see. And then the boy falls off the horse and breaks his leg. And the elder says, and everybody says, isn't that a tragedy? And the elder said, we'll see. And then the village goes to war and the boy can't go to war because of his broken leg. And isn't he lucky? And we'll see. Yeah. You know, you cannot let up off the gas pedal. You cannot be complacent or too self-satisfied. It is a complicated world. It is an interconnected world. There are threats that come, whether it's from technology, whether it comes from politics or ideology, they never stop. And I do think we believed we had won. It was our world to run. And it was a whole new reality. And it wasn't. It's the same reality that we've cycled through for 1,000 years.
Yeah, I like the anecdote because that's the same thing, you know, specific to, in this case, the Israeli Hamas nightmare that we're dealing with today. I remember reading a book from Thomas Friedman. It was from, I think it was called From Beirut to Jerusalem.
Yeah, it may have been his first book.
I think so. And it was just a phenomenal read. And it really helped me understand the culture of what was going on in the Middle East better than anything else. And he shared an anecdote similar to that, where there was a man with a family who believed that chickens would help him grow muscle. So he started to buy chickens and he bought a chicken because he thought it would be worth it. And one night the chicken was stolen. And so he got up in the morning and he was very upset and he went to his sons and he said, hey, they stole our chicken. I need you to go get the chicken. And the kids were like, yeah, dad's overreacting. They didn't really pay much attention to it. The next night, they stole the mule. Mm-hmm. And they said, daddy, they stole the mule. What do we need to do? And he said, go get the chicken. Right? And the next day, they came in and they burned down the barn. He said, daddy, what do we do? And he said, go get the chicken. Right? And the idea there, what that anecdote taught me, what that story taught me, was that the culture over there was you don't let people take advantage of you. Period. And if you don't go get the chicken, all this bad shit happens after the fact. And that's a big piece of the discussion. And this is, I've shared that story with my friends who are just adamant that Israel is evil. And then my other friends on the other side, that the other side's evil. You know, obviously we know Hamas was evil, but if you look at that, there's the whole, the conflict itself culturally is something I don't think we understand as Americans, right? Specific to that level of you got to come back harder. And I think that that's really where, if you look at in this discussion in general, is that are we Americans, have we done too much acquiescing when it comes to foreign policy? Because a lot of people talk about Obama, specific to Russia, right?
Right.
If you look at what took place with Georgia in 2008, he said, you know, don't do it. He did it. Crimea in 2014.
Right.
Kate did it. Didn't do anything, you know.
And, you know, in Syria, don't you dare use chemical weapons. That's our red line. Well, it's not really. Yeah,
but it's not really a red line. Yeah.
I don't think that's an unfair criticism. There are adversaries who basically only respect and react to a punch in the mouth.
Yeah.
And you have to be smart enough to know the time and the place for that. My, you know, Henry Kissinger, who just passed away not long ago, and who I had the privilege of working with and knowing for a few years, Henry was, you know, a lot of critics, a lot of people who
valid,
deeply hated Henry. But
but
when you would talk to him, he would say, "Look, if you're telling me that you want justice and order, I will tell you that it is much easier to reach justice once you have order. And it is far harder to create justice out of disorder. So first I want to create order, then we can pursue justice." And that is a very realistic view of the world, which is it does not cooperate. It is not easily defined. And people hold on to their angers and their offenses and their hurts for a hell of a lot longer than our foreign policy establishment pays attention to.
It's very true. But let me ask you this. Based on this theory and this actual discussion, what are your thoughts on Russia's recent attack in the Ukraine? Was it, I mean, the red line issues, the issues in Crimea, the risk in Georgia, did we, with our foreign policy and the chicken story, I mean, is that, do we need to hit back harder back then? And because we didn't, do you think that that was where Putin got his confidence to just say,
no, I actually don't think so. I think that this was unavoidable.
Okay.
This was, you know, for Putin and for his calculations, no matter what the outcome was, this was going to happen. There were different ways that it would pay dividends for him. And by the way, if you go back and you look, you realize how long he'd been preparing for this. The fact that, that the Russians were stockpiling currency reserves that people thought was strange and didn't make a lot of sense. And now you realize it was creating a hedge against the inevitable sanctions that were coming. I do not think it was ever avoidable. I mean, CIA Director Bill Burns, who's a former U.S. ambassador in Moscow, flew to Moscow, met with Putin, and basically laid the cards on the table. We know what you're doing. In fact, we're inside your own communications. We know what your capabilities are. I'm telling you, this is not going to go well for you. Let's find an off-ramp. And it did not matter. There was no way, there was no way to detour or discourage Putin from engaging in war with Ukraine, because no matter what the outcome, whether it was to prove to the world that he meant what he said, whether it was to boost Russian national pride, whatever it was, there was a dividend that he wanted to realize, and there was no way to get to stop him from going forward on this.
When did this meeting take place?
Took place in January, a month before the invasion.
Wow. Okay.
In fact, one of the things that I think the CIA did remarkably well was they worked hard to declassify information and put it into the public sphere so that the Russians understood, we know what they're doing. We know what their communications are. We know what their plans are. It was strategic. It was very, very smart. But I mean, that Bill Burns went there for this meeting is not a secret. You know, he's an outstanding director and has served the president and the country extremely well from day one.
Well, that's really nice to hear, because this is kind of why it's nice to talk with guys like you who are in the know. A lot of what's going on specific to pundits and on the 24-hour news cycle is that we, America, are come across weak. And no matter what we have done historically with Russia, you're dealing with a despot. You're dealing with the KGB guy who doesn't have any respect for anything other than taking over things, right?
And yet, let's be honest, you're dealing with a country whose entire economy is barely the size of the economy of the state of New York.
Right.
You're dealing with a country that, again, let's be honest, doesn't make anything the world wants. You know, the world is not lining up to buy Russian technology.
No.
Other than oil and gas, they really have nothing to offer the world. They are massively insecure. They feel constantly disrespected. And so all this is this belief that we have to recapture being a great power, and the world doesn't take us seriously unless we do these things.
And so that begs the question too, then, with China, if you look at yet another despot, right? What do you think our policy specific to, you know, this malaise that we have going on in our Congress today, specific to funding these wars and being a good geopolitical partner, how does that affect yet another despot as far as his beliefs? Do we have any understanding? Do you have any understanding of how Xi sees the world, how he sees us, you know, what that means to him?
Well, you know, what I find really interesting is that we have not better leveraged our economic interdependence. You know, we buy an awful lot from China. They need things from us as well. And they steal everything they possibly can. They steal, They steal every technology they can. They've hacked in, they've stolen our W-88 nuclear warhead design. They steal everything they can. Is it that they're incapable of designing it and fabricating it themselves, or is it just faster? It's probably the latter. But, you know, years ago, you know, in the debate around free trade, it was, what do we buy from China? We buy T-shirts and sneakers. What do we sell China? Supercomputers and Boeing aircraft. That's not bad math for us.
Right.
We are supporting high-paying, high-tech jobs and we are buying back low skill, low wage goods. And so I do think that we missed the opportunity to basically hammer out where our shared prosperity is connected. And there are things, there should be red lines. We should not be selling Taiwan out to anybody. That is a country that should determine its own future. But it is in both, it should be in both of our country's best interests to have robust trade and stable relationships and not to constantly be in conflict. But that requires the recognition that China is a great power. And they've achieved that with the force of government policy and the creativity of hackers.
Well, let me ask you this then. There's a lot of demography going on specific to China, right? I've read some Goldman Sachs reports. There's a pundit out there named Peter Zion who talks about the collapse of China. And I wanted to get your take on that. I mean, the demographics of China are pretty scary if you believe in demography, specific yes. statistics and what's going on with finance and how their system works, specifically their, you know, I don't even know what you'd call it. It's like a hybrid communism. But the idea there is that they don't have a new generation of people. And 70% of their birth rate has dropped since 2017. And it's really scary. And they fell short 100 million new births this year. They've fallen behind India for the first time ever.
Which is a demographic reality that we saw what it did to the Japanese economy. I mean, there is no replacement process.
Yeah.
Workers age, retire, and die, and nobody is there to step in. And it has weighed down the Japanese economy for a generation.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not just the birth rate and the replacement rate for workers, but it is also accounting that's unreliable
yep.
and debt burdens that are not transparent. And so, yeah, I mean, it looks like there is a real estate bubble that will be massive when it bursts. On the other hand, let's talk about, electric vehicles and the fact that they are poised to basically own that industry, not just because of their control of rare earth minerals, but their technology and how quickly they have mastered it. But I do agree with you that demographically there are some very ugly surprises, and the global ripple effect could be very frightening.
Yeah, that was one thing I get your take on too, because there are numbers on anywhere between 1.2 billion and 3 billion or apartments that are just sitting empty.
Right.
Right? Right. So all the buildings and their GDP is measured based on actual growth. It doesn't really matter. There's no other metric. It's like how much are we building, right? So that's, to your point, there's a lot of numbers statistically that we have a hard time gelling.
But there aren't enough consumers coming behind this generation.
Correct. And that's the scary part.
Look at our economy. Look at the last, year and a half, 2 years. What has pushed and driven and fueled our economic growth, our recovery, and the retreat of inflation? It's consumer spending.
Correct. And the consumers. That,
right. Yeah. But China doesn't have that. And so where are they in 10 and 20 years without that?
Well, that's the rumor around the campfire, is that they're in deep shit in 10, 15 years, specific to the demography. And then if you look at that, how does that affect our geopolitics in the sense that, what happens when they get desperate? And I think to your point, Russia is desperate and insecure, and they always have been. So, with us not supporting Ukraine, let's jump back to Russia for a second. If we continue to delay this, what do you think the ramifications are specific to that? And then obviously there's a lot of talk about the next step. If Ukraine does fall, Moldova, the Baltic states, a lot of people are signing up for NATO. If they can, what's happening on that front, at a macro level?
Look, let's kind of take the cartoonish Putin off the table.
Okay.
The man may be many things. He's not irrational and he's not suicidal. And he's well aware that NATO has three times as many forces in uniform and 10 times as much armor and air power. Okay. So he does not want to provoke a war with NATO. But of course, if you have a president of the United States saying we're going to ignore Article 5 and NATO's on its own, that's a different calculation. But provided we honor our commitments to NATO, yeah. Russia does not want war with NATO. But they will come right up to the edge and hope for a face-saving, some sort of compromise. Really, it's what does he want? You know, what does he want from the Baltics? What does he want from Moldova? Does he want... Yeah. They're not large economies.
No.
Ukraine was a large economy and a massive agricultural economy. But it is simply to reestablish, you know, the Russian Empire, to reestablish the Soviet Empire. And so, you know, if I'm smaller European countries, not under the umbrella of NATO, I want in. I want under that.
I would.
And by the same token, if I'm an American business owner, I worry about the loss of the European market. I worry about an EU that suddenly thinks that for their own stability and their own safety, they have to improve their relationship and their connectivity to Russia, because that then comes at our expense. The idea that you can you know, write Ukraine off is preposterous for the ripple effect and for what it says about American power and American loyalty and American prestige. And again, it goes back to what we first talked about. Values matter. You know, I remember just after 9/11, so much the conventional wisdom was half the world wants to blow up our embassies. And I remember it's not true. That is not the case. It's never been the case. You know what? Half the world wants visas from our embassies.
Right. It's the opposite. Yeah.
And that's still the case. But if you surrender Ukraine and you now have the EU saying, well, we need to raft ourselves up to Russia and become economically meaningful to them so that they leave us alone, the US pays the price for that.
So that answers my question, because what you just said is that should, you know, President Biden win another election, NATO's intact, we're good. Putin is not completely irrational in the sense that he wants to take on the NATO alliance, right?
Right.
So we're good. Let's play this out for a second on the game theory side of things. What happens if Mr. Trump wins election in 2024 and decides to, you know, poo-poo NATO or seriously, you know, change its its
mind? So what happens? You find Poland, Germany, Hungary trying to figure out how to be on Putin's good side. Sweden, okay. Finland, you know, are they going to second guess their commitment to NATO, or are they simply going to open up their borders, expand their trade with Russia, and try to make nice?
Try to make nice.
And how is that scenario in the U.S. interest in any way?
It doesn't seem to me to be a good thing.
Right. And so it goes back to what we talked about earlier. You know, Ronald Reagan, John McCain, you know, they would never recognize this party of theirs. They would never recognize, you know, basically, you know, the Republican Party is almost to the point of being, you know, Vladimir Putin's, you know, lap cat. They're just going to sit mm-hmm. there, and as long as he pets them, they'll purr and stay out of his way. I cannot fathom how that is in America's best interests.
I can't either. And so maybe we can just close on this, sir. What do you think is going to happen with our Congress specific to the budgets and the funding of these two wars?
I honestly do not know. I do not know what the math is or what the combination of events are that, you know, the Senate gets it.
Yeah.
But you've got a Speaker of the House that seems unwilling to take on the fringes of his own party. I mean, I think what I would hope, but I know it sounds incredibly naive, is that you have a certain number of Republican members of the House who are more centrist, more moderate, Republicans that come from California, New York, Pennsylvania, who at a certain point just say, I cannot be held hostage by this Freedom Caucus, the Freedom Caucus crazies. I just can't. Yeah. I am willing to cast my lot in with Democrats who are as centrist as I am and who see things the way I do on many things, not everything. I'm waiting for that moment where, you know, the center reholds. And the idea that you can, that it's a zero sum game of my party or nothing has to end. You know, democracy doesn't work without compromise. And when I worked on Capitol Hill a long time ago, it was populated with giants. It was Bob Dole and Pat Moynihan and Ted Kennedy, people who had served the country, the numbers that served in the military, John Chafee, Strom Thurmond, and they knew how to go into a corner and figure out a compromise where everybody got a little bit of a win. Nobody got everything they wanted. And then went back to the junior members and said, here's what we're going to do. And you tell me a junior member of the Republican Party who's going to tell Bob Dole to, you know, go fuck himself. Or who's going to tell Pat Moynihan he's wrong and he doesn't understand.
Yeah,
and those guys aren't there anymore. And that has not served the country well. You know, ideology above national interest is not working.
No, Mike Johnson's no Tip O'Neill, right? There's no question there.
He's no Tip O'Neill. He's no John Boehner.
Right.
You know, sometimes you've got to discipline your own party. Sometimes you've got to reach across the aisle. You know, the Tip O'Neill and Ronald Reagan could quietly work together. That Boehner and Obama, or Ted Kennedy and Orrin Hatch.
Yeah,
that's what made government work. Powerful leaders who understood the national interest first, and they've been replaced by people who don't have that view, and aren't bold enough and aren't brave enough to get there.
Wow. Well, I will let you go, sir. I know you have lots to do. You need to get some sleep. It's late there in Cairo. And again,
I can hear the call to evening prayers behind me. it's nighttime in Cairo. All is good here.
Again, thank you, sir, for your time. I look forward to continuing our conversations. And thanks again for everything. Really appreciate it.
Good seeing you, Joe.
All right. Cheers. Thanks for tuning in, everyone. If you dig what we're doing over here, please subscribe. And while you're at it, please download an episode or two and leave a review. I'd love to hear your thoughts. Until next time, big hugs.